You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings, saying hello to everybody today. Hello.
Hey, how are you doing, everyone? So we thought we would do something a little different today. Bruce and I, in our consulting, we always talk to our clients about the importance of self-advocacy. We believe the best strategy in resolving problems is when the individual is advocating for themselves on the inside, and we're advocating from the outside. And sometimes we get a little pushback, you know, oh, my case manager doesn't do this, or my case manager won't listen. And we think it's just really, really important. Part of the reason we wrote the book, and we kind of joke about it kind of putting us out of business a little bit, you know, because we wrote a book on the ins and outs of FSA. And if you read the book, you get a lot of knowledge. We go into depth and explain in the different parts of the policy and some of the issues that have been coming up. And we even talk about some of the court cases. You know, we want to people to really educate themselves. And this isn't, for me, this isn't something new. As a case manager and as a case management coordinator, I always wanted my guys and my gals on my caseload to get their GED, to take ESL, you know, to be able to take care of themselves and not have to rely on someone else to ask questions for them or explain things to them. So we thought we would talk about today. Well, go ahead.
But I do want to underscore, look, that's why you hire us. Obviously, that outside advocacy is, I don't think anybody's ever hired us that we didn't come into play somewhere with
Absolutely.
Getting their stuff done and finished. So it's not to say that, you know, but I'm with Susan, is that you do everything, or your loved one can do everything in reason that they can. And in some respects, some people maybe walk away too soon, or they don't want to piss off their case manager or their staff, so that, you know, so but there are certain things that your loved one is entitled to, and they do have access, and they can look at some certain things in their file and take notes. They might not be able to get a copy of some things, but they can see the file, and they can, except for certain things, but they can take notes right. on stuff in their PSR or whatever. So everybody has to do their share, is what we're kind of saying. And so, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are times that, and it's because we have our contacts and our resources, that we're able to pick up the phone and talk to the right person or send the right email to the right person to get things fixed. And we've had to do that just in the last couple of weeks. We had a couple of clients. One resulted in immediate release. Another client wasn't getting their time credits at all. And we were able to intervene and get that ball rolling. And so we were
Absolutely.
Really excited to do that.
Absolutely.
But also this last week, in fact, we had a meeting this morning where the question was asked, well, does he have the right to look at his pre-sentence investigation report? 100%. And that wasn't, interestingly, that was not our first issue just this week, this past mm-hmm. week, this is Monday. So this past week, related to things about the pre-sentence investigation report and the central file. Or getting copies out of the central file. So, that's, I think where a good place is to start is that program statement. That's 5800.17 is the inmate central file privacy folder and parole mini files. What's in that file? That's that policy. That policy is everything that dictates the handling of the inmate central file. Okay. Things that are in there that are important is someone being able to get a copy of something out of their central file. We have case managers out there who don't know, don't realize, or don't want to, provide an individual a copy of their halfway house referral form. That is located in Section 5 of the central file. It is a disclosable document, and the program statement on central file specifically says an inmate can request a copy of a document in his central file. Okay. Now, there are restrictions. You can't have a copy of your PSR. We all know that. That's actually spelled out in the policy. But you can certainly review it. And we'll get to reviewing your central file next. But when a loved one is talking to a case manager, their unit manager, whomever, cite the policy. It's page 11 of the policy that talks about getting a copy. Cite the policy. And if it doesn't work informally, you send, you know, you talk to your case manager, you ask him, hey, can I get a copy? No, you're not allowed to have a copy. Really? Are you, I'm not allowed to? It's in the policy. It says I can. No, I can't give you that without permission. Okay. So you use the electronic inmate request to staff member, and you send an email through the CoreLink system that allows for the inner email to the unit manager and request a copy. Cite the program statement.
Quoting the program.
The policy. Statement. Okay. Cite it. Now, back when Bruce and I were working on caseloads, there wasn't an electronic method of sending emails. The electronic system only came out, let me think, it was in the early 2000s. I was a case management coordinator at the time. And at that time, only department heads got them. In fact, the initial rollout, they all went to the warden's office, and then he decided what was going to be distributed from there.
Wow.
But those are, that's how long ago it was. But those are readily available. Yeah, we're talking 2000, maybe 5-ish, maybe.
Wow.
6, somewhere in that vicinity. I can't remember that far back. I've slept. But, you know, when I was a case manager, when Bruce was a DTS, cop-outs were a piece of paper, right? And, you know, hopefully, you know, like I kept them all. I liked getting cop-outs because that kept things in order for me, right? If someone came and asked me a question at mainline or during shoe rounds, and, you know, shoe, I might have a tablet with me, but mainline, I didn't carry a pen and paper. So I'd be like, bring me a cop-out. You know, that was my reminder to send you a copy of whatever or answer a question. But if I was a not organized case manager or whatever, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't get a cop-out. Now it's electronic and there's a means to track it. What does that mean? That means when I send something to my unit manager and he says, no, you can't have that, even though I cited the policy. When I go to the warden next and I say, I submitted a request to my unit manager on this date, and on this date, he replied back electronically that I was not entitled to it. But the program statement on page 11 says I can request a copy of a disclosable document. You've got a track record. You've got documentation. We have a client right now that printed and saved every single email that he sent and received to staff about his situation. And because of those documents, we're in a better position to assist him and his family because he just doesn't have, well, I told him this. He's got it in writing and what their response was.
He got the receipts. Yeah.
He's got receipts. That's huge, right? Yeah. So the Inmate Central File policy is maybe one that a lot of folks don't think about, but super, super important. Another section of the policy, being able to review a central file. Now, if I get a request from someone on my caseload, what the policy says, it doesn't say I have to schedule it today or tomorrow, but it says within a reasonable period of time. Let's take reasonable to be less than 30 days, right? less than 2 weeks realistically, but let's be generous. Let's say less than 30 days, unless there's a time sensitive issue. They should be scheduled. Your case manager should be putting you on call out, scheduling you to come in. They're going to sit you in the conference room. Maybe they have you sit in their office. I never had them sit in my office because I had work to do. I had them sit in the conference room across from my office. And they're going to remove the FOIA exempt section. That's the non-disclosable section. You don't get to look at that. And you can sit there with a pen and paper. And if you want to transcribe your entire PSR, that's exactly what you can do. That is your right. That is something. And that's the conversation we had this morning. The question was about looking at the PSR to see what the individual's defense attorney objected to.
Right.
And so for those of you who are less familiar with pre-sentence investigation reports, generally speaking, on the back of it, after the end of the report, there's generally a document that will list objections from defense and then response from defense. And sometimes, not always, but if there's no objections, there'll even be that objections from defense kind of letterhead cover, and then it'll just say there were no objections filed. Our guidance to them was you need to contact your case manager. If you get pushback from the case manager, send an electronic request to the unit manager requesting a time to review your PSR.
Yeah.
And have a tablet and a pen and transcribe verbatim what's there. You're allowed to do that. Now, is the case manager allowed to say, hey, I've only got an hour for you? If you need more than that, we're going to have to schedule another time. 100%. Does it have to be the case manager? No. Correctional counselor, unit secretary, unit manager has to be a staff member that sets it up. Are you allowed to take anything out of your file? No. They're probably not going to sit in the room with you. They may be outside the room because you're not allowed to take anything out of the file, but you can transcribe to your heart's content. Two very, very important rights that every individual serving time needs to know. Also, go ahead.
I was going to say, are you going to talk about the 210? Are you going to wait? Or can I ask my 210 question?
You go ask your 210 question.
Can they have a copy of the 210?
Yes. Period. So when you look
at
it's
real important.
It's really important. We did say that once. We're repeating it again for this reason. That's why it's that important. When you look at that program statement, and I would encourage, obviously, we're not broadcasting in the prison, but for those out here, share with your loved ones. When they look and read through that policy, which all the policies are available in the law library, when they review that policy, in there is a list of the documents and in the order and what sections of the central file they belong in. So your judgment and commitment order is in section one, along with your sentence computation and rap sheet and things like that. In section two is your pre-sentence investigation report, your progress report, your team sheets, and so on. Section five is the release section. And that's where you find documents related to release, pre-release placement, relocation letter from probation, approving a relocation or denying it. If a probation officer denies a relocation, that letter is put in section five. It's disclosable. It says in there, why did they deny it? Well, I denied it because there was guns and firearms in the house. That's a legitimate reason to deny it, and they put it in the letter. Okay. Rarely does a probation officer come back and say, well, this is the reason and it's non-disclosable. That rarely happens. It could, but it rarely happens.
But also on the, maybe we'll get to this at a time, but the way the case manager or the team, the unit team, recommended the community placement, did they say 100 to 151 days? Did they say 3 months. So, you know, so I sometimes that nuance on that recommendation means a lot.
And 100%.
There's variability Absolutely. On how those are done. All right.
We had a client who on a 210, you have a requested date on the top, on the left-hand side about quarter of the way down. And then at the very bottom, there's a narrative section. And at the top, they put a date. And at the bottom, they put 180 days. Okay, at the top, the date was a six-month date. They looked at the current date, went back 6 months, and picked that date. That six-month date was not 180 days. And the difference was about 5 days, 4 days, including, well, less, but because of the weekends, and then we don't transfer people on the weekends. So it turned out to be a 4 or 5 day difference. It was the difference between like a Thursday and a Tuesday. We lobbied aggressively. In that case, that was unsuccessful, but we lobbied aggressively to say the warden did sign off on this date. And the reentry office in that case was like, no, the case manager said 180 days, you know, they said 180 days and this is 180 days and this is not. But those consistencies, those inconsistencies, I should say,
there you go,
are a problem.
Right.
We're looking at cases today. So last week's show, we talked about kind of some of the recent changes that have been really good and really exciting. But one of the things that hasn't happened and I want to see next, me personally, is the Bureau right now uses the conditional calculator as a snapshot, right? When you're at the 10-day earning rate, the very beginning of your sentence, it calculates those days at the 10-day rate as if the 10-day rate was going to stay for the entire term of incarceration, rather than saying, oh, well, how much time do they have left? Okay, well, he's going to have 28 days and then 90 days or 28 days and then 180 days and then it's going to be 15 and what's it going to be? And kind of roll in that those assumptions of going from the 10 to the 15 as opposed to a snapshot at the current time. Because of that, we see referrals submitted early. Now, sometimes it's unavoidable. Individual has a short sentence. If they don't submit them now, the person runs the risk of not getting placement if we wait it to for the 118 days, 120 days before the date change. Sometimes it's unavoidable. But if the case manager is paying attention and goes, hey, wait a minute, this person's date's going to change. Let's request, instead of a 3 month placement, let's request 120 days. Let's bump it up. Now, that's where being aware of how things right. work and self-advocating. So if you're sitting there at your initial classification, you're brand new coming into the Bureau, but because you prepared yourself, you got our books, you had a pre-arrival orientation, we went over everything with you, you knew exactly what your dates were going to be, because that's one of the things we do. We manually calculate the dates, so you go in armed. And if at your initial classification, because you have a shorter sentence, the case manager says, well, we're going to go ahead and recommend a 90-day placement because, you know, your sentence is only this long, we're not going to be able to do anything until you're time credits start posting, but as soon as it posts and we have that conditional date, we're going to recommend 90 days. And then you come back with, thank you, I really appreciate that. Hey, but because I've got a short sentence, my conditional release date is actually going to change on this date when I go from 10 to 15. And if you wait to do the paperwork, it'll be too late by then. Can you recommend a 420-day month placement
right.
to account for the 30 days that my date's going to change? You're coming into that with knowledge. Knowledge is power.
And you're that is so much easier to fix that right then.
That is so much easier.
Coming in later and trying to get that fixed up. And I'm going to bring up another scenario. Yes. Go ahead and finish your thought.
I was just going to say, being able to have that conversation, but while we're in the recommending phase, right, before any paperwork has been done, and saying, well, you know what? And that's a reasonable request. Now, they can say no. But let's bring it up early, you know, not right. when the date's back and it's wrong. And now your placement date is actually after your conditional release date. And yes, that has happened. Not as much now. It's getting better, but that does happen. Yeah. You were going to say, Bruce.
All right. This isn't going to be very popular, but here it goes. So we've been talking on the show about the likelihood or the new way, it's not new, but anyway, the new wave where people will pretty much just get home confinement if they have a home to go to and all this other stuff. However, if you had done a release plan, and we've had clients like this where the release plan talked about, hey, I can no longer do this career. I have to find another career. I have to find another job. So I need more time in the community to get at least my vocational skills established so that I can provide or whatever and go back in there, which would require a community placement that includes both RRC and home confinement. But this is the self-advocacy piece of that story. From the rip, from the beginning of your release planning and your dialogues with team and your case manager from the first one, hey, I'm going to have to retool this and that and the other so the unit team knows your story, that you're going to have to do some stuff. Look, it'll certainly help. But again, if it's coming from you or your loved one, as the story is progressing, before the 210 is done, at least your loved one has a chance of informing the team to get a maximized placement, if you will. Look, I know it's, and there's variability. We hear stories all the time. Well, my case manager is just doing home confinement, and that's it. We hear other stories where they don't, from other institutions or other case managers in the same damn institution. You have variability.
So let's talk about residency when we're talking about self-advocate. Yeah. Okay, come into team. Do you have a place to go? Yeah, my cousin's going to let me stay at his house. Okay, that's awesome.
Good point.
That you've got a cousin willing to let you surf his sofa. And maybe he even has an extra room. Yeah. But when we're talking about home confinement versus halfway house,
right?
Your cousin putting you up, a friend who's willing to let you stay at their house, that is not a pre-release plan. That is a transitional placement. That's what halfway house is. Because is your cousin going to want you to sleep on his sofa for the 180 days or the 120 days of home confinement that you've got coming? Because you do have the home confinement eligibility, and eat his food and use his electricity and his water and not contribute because you don't have a job yet, because you're just coming out of prison. That is different than you're going back to the home you lived in prior to incarceration. You're going back to your spouse or your partner that you were with prior to incarceration. That's even different than going back to your mom or dad's, or mom and dad's, right? You know, parents put up with more. That's just the nature of being a parent. Right? They put up with more. So maybe they're okay with you living in the back bedroom for the next 6 months while you get your life together. But your cousin, a friend, an ex who you're still friendly with, that is not a release plan.
Right.
So telling your case manager that you have a place to go, is it really? What if your cousin's situation changes?
Right. But if it is, I mean, you got to go with it, because we've seen, we had the guy, whatever, Nevada got, he was with his brother, he stayed with his brother, he got home, you know. So, I mean, he did get home confinement on that. If that's what it is, it is. But just be advised that, but actually, that's kind of a good reason to get more halfway house, just to say, 100%. Hey, I want to have my own residence. I want to have my own apartment or maybe a better, more stable living situation because they're going to check. Staff is going to go out there and check. And if that person waffles, like, oh, yeah, I said that to them to be nice. I really don't want them. You know, we have a case here recently that the wife was calling us and all of a sudden, like, I don't want him really coming back. You know what I mean? And we're like, wait a minute. That ship has sailed. You know, he's coming. He's coming out, you know. Anyway.
But, yeah, so that's where self-advocacy is so important. Yeah. And I was going to jump, actually, we kind of led into it early, but the unit management manual and inmate program review. Being prepared for your program review is, I can't emphasize how important that is. One is from a selfish standpoint, as a prior case manager, I've probably got 10 team meetings scheduled today, right? Back to back. And I've got 10 minutes for you because I've got to get everybody done and get all the files put away. And I got all this stuff to do, right? So I got about 10 minutes for you in the proper team. If you come into team and you're ready, you've got all your questions ready. I've probably, at least as I was a case manager, I talked to you ahead of time. You told me what questions you had. I told you what documents I wanted you to bring in the team. We're on the same page. You come in prepared. If you come in prepared and we can slide through your team, get what we need to get done. On the other hand, if I'm going through and I'm asking you questions and you're like, I don't know. I'll have to get back with you. Okay, that's fine. But I've got other people. We're going to keep rolling on work. And do you want your work to get done? Or are you going to let it slide for a week or 2 weeks or 2 months or 4 months and then come back? And now I'm getting your paperwork done, but instead of me being able to send your halfway house request out 4 or 5 months in advance or more, I'm sending it out 75 days in advance. It's still on time by policy. Policy says it's supposed to be sent out 60 days ahead of time. So it's still on time. I've still done my job. But as Bruce likes to say, halfway house is like making a hotel reservation.
Book at a hotel. Yes.
Book early. And again, being prepared for that. When you come to team, we talk about this in the FSA book, right? You are entitled to get a copy of your team sheet, your FSA worksheet, your pattern worksheet, and your needs assessment worksheets. At every single team. Every team.
Yeah, I'd get those. Yeah,
I can't tell you how many times we ask.
Does your loved one have their
worksheet? Right. And they're like,
what?
I don't know. Or we get one, but it's from 6 months ago
or eight months ago. Yeah, it's really
it's
old. Yeah.
Right? If your case manager doesn't have it in their hand, ask for it. And the right to have those documents is spelled out in the unit management manual, MA program review, that is 5140.42. Okay. It was only put out, I think it was published, the newest version was published in 2024. There was a change notice in 2025 with the executive orders, but it's a new, maybe it was 25. No, I think it was late 24 was put out. Anyway. That spells out information about pattern and how pattern is done, but it talks about those documents. And again, it is your right to get it.
And some of our folks that are in mediums or have pattern of medium want to keep those, right? That pattern to know when they're going to be pattern risk low enough to receive FSA.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Here's another thing. If you either retain them yourself, or better, you make a copy and you send them home. It is what it is, but sometimes stuff gets lost. You're moving from institution to institution, stuff gets packed. You're like, do I really need this? This is from 2 years ago. We've actually had cases where we reviewed successive team sheets and we tracked an individual through 18 months worth of team sheets. And it's because every time he got a team sheet, he sent it home. He didn't need to have it with him. If he needed it back, his family member would have made a copy and sent it back. But every single document that he received from a Bureau staff member went home. And the family kept a file. And we were able to track this particular issue, had to do with Halfway House, over the course of three consecutive teams. And that was super helpful in solving the problem. Because having one team sheet is great, but in this case, there was a change with an RDAP status and before RDAP, and then he was in RDAP, mm-hmm. and you know, and then there was a sentence reduction and blah, blah, blah. And by being able to track that all the way through was what gave us the ammunition to write the information up, to send it right back to him. So then he could go back to his unit team and explain it,
right,
and say, hey, now, does your unit team have that access? Sure, they do. Central team sheets are retained for six intervals. So in theory, that could be as much as 3 years. They are cumulative. They're a lot better than it used to be in the past. When I started, team sheets were one page, carbonless copy, and you had to write really tiny if you had a lot to put on there, sometimes in the margins. But again, it goes back to taking care of yourself, protecting yourself, have those documents. Going back to team and recommendations for Halfway House or home confinement. We have recently been hearing from more than one individual where the unit team made a recommendation, and then following the June 17th memo from the director, a case manager, not a new team, not the unit team, meaning with the unit manager, a case manager came back and said, oh yeah, I'm not putting you in for Halfway House. I'm putting you in for home confinement. A recommendation for pre-release custody, pre-release placement, is a unit team decision. It is not a case manager's decision. If they want to make a change, they need to do another five-factor review. What was in that first five-factor review that doesn't support the change?
Oh, how many institutions do you think the case manager is making that solo, doing it solo like that?
I'm not willing to put money on that.
So what does that mean? It's supposed to be a unit team. The whole team is there, and then they decide collectively, right?
At a minimum, a unit team is comprised of the unit manager, correctional counselor, and the case manager, and there needs to be at least two of the three. So yes, if my case manager came back and said, you're only getting this, as I would be asking about the team, my new team sheet, because that's a team decision. If someone gets in trouble and there's a decision to be made about whether or not they're keeping the Halfway House. Now, I'm not talking about you had a date, you got in trouble, and the reentry office took your date, because that happens too. I'm talking about you had a recommendation, right, and then you got in trouble, and now the case manager is saying, oh, I'm not putting you in. You got in trouble. Okay, going back to knowing your rights, if an individual is going to be denied outright, they're not going to be given Halfway House. Not because of a detainer or pending charge or kind of those kind of base stuff, but because of an institution issue, misconduct. The warden needs to approve that. Now, the warden may delegate it to the associate warden, but it is not delegated down to the case manager. Or the unit manager, for that matter. If they're going to be denied, it either is signed off by the warden or the associate warden if it's been delegated to them. And then it becomes that copy, that document is proof of a decision and becomes grounds for administrative remedy. And that we'll talk about that and we'll get to, gotta watch my time. We should get to that, but that's really important. Again, knowing what your rights are. Another big area we see a lot of discussion on is inmate security designation and custody classification. For those of you keeping track, that is 5100.08, change notice 2. That is a manual. That is a whole book. I've got two copies here in my office right now that I regularly use even now. And in my custody classification manual, I used to affectionately joke that I knew it better than the Bible. And that was mostly true. I mean, there were a few things I might be able to quote, but out of my classification manual, not only could I tell you what it said, but if I was standing at mainline, I could tell you, well, it's going to be in chapter 4. It's going to be on the left-hand side page, about a third of the way down. Like, visually, I knew my manual.
Right.
And I had it all tabbed out and would flip, because regular questions I came up, I'd flip to it when I was answering questions. As an individual sitting in custody, you should know the custody classification manual as well as, I won't say better, as well as you know your Bible. And if you don't know your Bible well, or your Quran, or your Torah, or whatever religious book you depend on, then you need to know the classification manual better. We have it happen regularly. We have cases right now we're working on with administrative remedies where the institution has not scored the individual correctly. And we are working with them to fight on their behalf. But sometimes it doesn't take administrative remedy. Sometimes it just takes a conversation. In one of our particular cases, the individual has two issues going on. We provided language for both of them. He got one fixed immediately with just a conversation. The second one, we're working on administrative remedy with them.
We got a DSCC, but that was maybe something different. Where the DSCC fixed it? Anyway.
Well, I wasn't thinking about that one. I was thinking about an institution one that we got
institution,
fixed.
Okay. Yeah.
Excuse me. In that case, we were able to, with the, we were able to provide some additional documentation to show that there was no plea agreement, that it in fact was just outright dismissed. But it was important because it was impacting his classification in that particular situation. He was being assigned a sex offender public safety factor, and that is one of the only, in fact, probably the only one that even if there's a dismissal, if the dismissal was in lieu of a plea agreement to something else, you can still be held to it. And we had to show that there was no plea, that he in fact had all of the charges dismissed, and we were able to get it corrected. And
that was prior, it was prior conduct.
And that was prior to him
offense, nothing
coming
else,
into, know. and he was in custody yet. So that's why we were,
right.
He didn't have the ability to talk to someone. And I know we're getting close, but want to talk about administrative remedies versus torts. Now, my big thing I'm going to say with this is, one, again, read that administrative remedy policy. I find most of that the population is actually more knowledgeable on administrative remedies in terms of timelines and when they can elevate it to another to another level, although we still see some of that at each level, at the institution or the regional level, they can get a delay. They can get an extension on their timeline. And as the individual, you can't go to the next level until they've passed the second extension. But I also, when I was in the institution, when I was in the regional office, saw individuals having their complaint, and their remedy is either I want money or I want someone fired. Okay, I can just tell you right now, if you ask for money on an administrative remedy, it's going to be denied, because administrative remedies cannot provide monetary relief as a remedy. That's what a tort claim is for. That's right. First. Second, if you make a complaint and your remedy is, I want this person fired, I want this person disciplined, whatever language you use, right? your response back is something going to be something along the lines of, we take all complaints regarding misconduct seriously. It will be referred to the appropriate authority and you will not be advised of the results. When you file administrative remedy, you are focusing on the policy and the policy-based relief. I was denied, my unit team recommended me for 90 days of halfway house. My unit team did not recommend me for halfway house, it was only recommending me for direct home confinement, and I have this needs, and this is what it is. These are my needs. And as relief, I would like a recommendation for pre-release placement for 90 to 120 days, right. 120 to 180 days, whatever it is. If your goal is just to rant, administrative remedy is your waste of time. I'm just telling you. I mean, you can do it. It's not going to accomplish anything. Administrative remedies need to be succinct. We've talked about this on a previous show, but we still see folks coming and they want, or they've submitted an 8.5 and a 9 together. That's not how it works. Understanding that policy, reading it through, understanding your timelines. There are cases because there is a timeline. And let's say you officially technically miss your timeline. Well, you can make another request and have it denied again, and that restarts your clock. If you understand how the policy works and you've read it and you're not wasting your time just asking for somebody to be fired because they're mean or racist or incompetent or whatever adjective you want to use, and you focus on what it is you're wanting to get from a policy standpoint. Do you want a transfer? Do you want a halfway house? Do you want home confinement? Is it about FSA? What is the issue? If it's a medical issue and you want a dental appointment, then your remedy is, I want to be scheduled for dental. You know, keep it simple. Just saw a BP10 today, right on the line, right? It was right on point. It was short. It was sweet. It's to the point. Here's the problem. In this case, it was a sensitive 10. And in the first line, person explained why it was a sensitive 10, gave some examples of some of the things they've already been experiencing, and then said, this is what I want. It was four sentences. Bruce, you saw it. I think it was four sentences.
Yeah.
That has the potential to go all the way through very smoothly and quickly and get resolved, rather than someone who goes on for the full section on the 9 and into their one page extension, writing in a handwritten font that I am amazed you could write that small, with lots of big words and lots of adjectives and lots of legalese. And it goes nowhere, or it takes forever to work through.
Or these long-winded dissertation writers, and they might get one or two or three of the subpoints wrong. He's like, bro, so if the reviewing official says, well, this was wrong and this was wrong, you got nothing coming. See what I mean? Whereas Susan just said, it's just real clean, simple. It's pretty much yes or no, and that's a good wrap. You know, this other stuff, and you... These prolific writers, you just set themselves up for more error, and they set themselves up for an increased chance of failure. Just saying.
Yeah. So team, central files, and reading policy in general. All of those publicly available policies are available in the law library for folks in custody. If you're in the halfway house, home confinement, or you're not arrived yet, you're looking at a prison term, if you're a family member, they are available on the public website. Read them, and read them more than once. And if you have questions, that's where Bruce and I come in. Bruce and I can break it down and we can explain it. But you don't want to be flying blind, not as a family member, not as being incarcerated. You know, I, as a case manager, I considered myself pretty damn good, if I do say so myself. And I took the time to explain to folks. My philosophy was, if I take 10 minutes to explain this to you, then you don't write the warden, you don't file a 9, you don't do this, and I don't have to waste my time responding 17 times to the same question. So I took the extra time and explained it to you. At various times in my career, that was easier or harder, depending on how large my caseload was. When I had 140 folks, that wasn't bad. When I had 210, it was a challenge. And then a lot of our case managers today are experiencing high caseloads. So they may not have the time to spend 10 minutes or 15 minutes with you explaining the policy. That's where folks like Bruce and I can be very,
very helpful.
Very, very helpful. That's why Bruce and I wrote the two books we did. We are planning a third book on the Second Chance Act. That'll be toward the springtime. You know, those are there to educate you.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Wind her up.
So,
last thoughts.
Really, I don't have any last thoughts. This, all right. I think we really. I hope everyone out there gets where we're coming from in terms of we want you to advocate for your loved one. We want your loved ones to advocate for themselves. And don't hope, as I once had an administrator tell me, hope is not a strategy. Hope is not a strategy. Hoping everything works out the way it's supposed to is hopeful, but that's all it is.
Right.
It's hopeful. And, you know, and Bruce and I know we talk to folks who have really great case managers at the RRCs, really responsible RRM administrators, really responsible case managers and responsive staff. And then we have others that struggle. And we hear it. We know what institutions they are. And sometimes we get calls. And I'll be like, oh, it's another one from there. Because I know the challenges they're experiencing. And it does frustrate me. I prided myself on being a very responsive case manager and case management coordinator. And it kind of irritates me. You want to put a plug in for our books?
Here we go. Yeah, buy our books. No, the blue book. Yeah, the FSA federal
unlocking FSA federal credit time book, credits second edition.
Unlocking federal time, and then the green book. Get them on Amazon. I'll put a link up on our Facebook group or Facebook page.
Absolutely.
Either the next show we have or the show after, we may be taking your calls live. Yeah, boy, that's gonna be put us on blast. We may do that, so stand by for that fun. You can see our shows on Apple Podcast, Amazon Audible, and of course on LA Talk Radio. You can listen to them, you can see them, you can pick your format, so it's all free of charge, and you can look at our prior episodes, and so that's good. Also, our First Step Act YouTube channel is picking up some good steam, and of course our Facebook group, Early Release from Federal Prison First Step Act. It's a great resource. So we have all those great resources and touch points for us. Leave us comments on any of the social media touch points. We'll try to get back with you. So buy the blue book and the green book. But the blue book for the holidays coming up, your loved one can read it, and you can read it at home and really get an understanding of what the First Step Act is, what it means, and how it's going to be applied in your loved one's case. And even if they're a medium or whatever, maybe hopefully soon they'll come down in their level and then they'll be able to participate in the First Step Act process. So yeah, awesome. Well, with that, everybody have a great, blessed, and safe week. And we'll see everybody here next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody. See you next time.
Bye. Take care.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.